new environmental requirements in Europe, sortation that is revved up and ready, and is the freight recession about to shift into reverse? Pull up a chair and join us as the editors of DC Velocity discuss these stories, as well as news and supply chain trends, on this week's Logistics Matters podcast. Hi, I'm Dave Maloney. I'm the Group Editorial Director at DC Velocity. Welcome. Logistics Matters is sponsored by Yale Lift Truck Technologies. At Yale, they believe effective material handling goes beyond simply moving product from point to point. Instead, their full line of warehouse lift trucks and technologies are designed to tackle your toughest labor, safety, and productivity challenges. It's time to rethink what you expect from your forklifts. Learn more at yale.com. As usual, our DC Velocity senior editors Ben Ames and Victoria Kickham will be along to provide their insights into the top stories of this week. But to begin today, the European Union has agreed to new rules requiring companies to act if their supply chains cause environmental damage. Many North American companies, of course, have operations in Europe or at least receive goods and services from there. So what exactly are the new requirements? To find out, here is Ben with today's guest. Ben?
Thank you, Dave. That's right. Supply chain visibility has been a buzzword for years now, but the meaning of that phrase has changed dramatically over time. For a long time, visibility simply meant having an answer to that perpetual question of where's my package? But in recent years, having oversight over your entire supply chain has become a method to reach many other goals, such as monitoring greenhouse gas emissions, doing risk analysis to avoid supply chain disruptions, or detecting forced labor conditions and sweatshops that might be operated by your suppliers. The latest evolution of visibility is a move to tighten environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, regulations across Europe. It's done through something called the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. CS3D is the abbreviation. That's a mouthful. So here to talk with us about what all this means and what U.S. companies need to do to stay in compliance is John Lash. He's the Group Vice President of Product Strategy at global supply chain platform E2Open. Welcome, John.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
Glad you could join us. First off, maybe you could give a quick description of what E2Open does and your role there, just so our listeners can get a sense of your position in this discussion.
Sure thing, Ben. For those that don't know us, E2Open serves large brands that make, move, and sell goods around the world. And we help them make more connected supply chain decisions. So think decisions that go beyond their operations to include what's happening across the extended value chain for better business outcomes. And this kind of connected thinking has been increasingly important these days because brands no longer compete against other brands, but really against their entire value chains. And today, sub-tiers is where you win or lose the race. So my role at E2Open is I head up product strategy, as you mentioned there, Ben. And think of this as defining the long-term strategy for where we're headed and why. So it's essentially like our North Star, so to speak.
So let's get into this Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. As we mentioned, this is a set of rules applied by regulators in the EU. So does it apply to US-based companies too?
Yeah, and what's really important to recognize is that Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, that is, as you said, quite a mouthful. It applies not only to European companies, but all companies that do business in Europe. They're referred to as Category 1 and Category 2 companies, respectively, but the same rules go and apply to both. And, you know, one of the things here is that the European directive, it applies to forced labor anywhere in the world. Right. Whereas when you compare that to, you know, America's UFLPA, which is really geared towards Uyghur forced labor prevention, that's really limited to forced labor in the Xinjiang province of China. So, you know, when you think of it, the European directive is a lot larger in scope. And it also has much bigger teeth in terms of penalties. The fine for noncompliance are up to 5% of global revenues. Not just revenues from Europe, but global revenues. And you might say, well, 5%, what does this mean? Like, put it in context. Well, if you look at an average Fortune 100 company, the average revenue there is around $40 billion. So 5% of 40 billion is $2 billion, which is pretty significant. And what's more, if you look at this in terms of earnings, which typically run around 10% of revenues, this means the 5% global penalty is roughly half of earnings for these companies, which really makes this an existential situation for them. And if that's not enough to get CEOs' attention, there's even language in the directive around civil liability. So think jail time for executives, which goes and makes it really personal indeed.
Wow, you have my attention. So what do qualifying companies then have to be on the lookout for? And, you know, are they difficult to detect?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you got to be looking out for is that an inherent challenge with the European directive and other forced labor laws is that the liability goes and extends beyond your operations and your tier ones to all your sub tiers. And it's not likely that forced labor is in your tier ones, unless you're really, you know, you're working with some pretty dodgy partners, but it's more likely in your tiers three, fours, or fives. And that's what you got to look out for. And part of the challenge here is, you know who your tier ones are. The problem is you don't even know your tier twos, let alone your three, fours, and fives. And that makes this really difficult to detect and manage.
Supremely difficult. Yeah. So, I mean, what sort of tools are we talking about, software technology or corporate management strategies or something else, are available for achieving those goals?
Yeah, so like we've already talked about, it's inherently sub-tier in nature. That's where the liability of your risk lies. It's deep in these sub-tiers with companies you don't know. So to the point, how do you go about protecting your company and what kind of tools can you use? Well, the first step is to know who you don't know. And the best way to do that is through the structured exchange of information to go and discover the sub-tiers and create network mappings. And, you know, one of the strategies that some companies have used is they send a letter to the tier ones and they kind of hope for the best, right? You know, tell us, you know, get your other tier twos and et cetera to go and share that. Well, hope really isn't a strategy. You know, instead, it's really much better to put in place a structured exchange of information that progressively expands your sub-tier network visibility. And that's something like our supply network discovery tool does that. But then once you've got the network mapping of your sub-tiers, then it's important to go in and apply screening at both the entity level, like who you're working with, and the transactional level of what goods are flowing along for that. And, you know, also to can go and consider, since you're doing that, don't just look at the forced labor, but also, you know, dealing with restricted parties and the 50% rule, where you can have hidden ownership in structures of different parties that you're dealing with. So you can go and cover all of your compliance bases. So basically those two steps, first one is discover, and then the second one is screen. And it's kind of helpful when those are on the same platform because it reduces the amount of integration that you need to do. Right. But the hardest nut to crack here is that sub-tier discovery and mapping. And you know, once you've got that done, the great news is you can use it for other places as well.
Right. That makes sense. Once you have that map, then you can examine what all the details are, I guess.
Yeah. And use it, you know, there are other kinds of applications where this goes and applies to, like scope three or circularity or risk, as you were mentioning at the beginning.
Gotcha. So there's a whole lot to be looking out here for. You know, what are some stumbling blocks maybe that U.S. companies should be on the lookout for? I know some other regions or nations, you mentioned that the Uyghur forced labor already have some rules around things like these. Are there lessons that we can learn from troubles, you know, that companies have had in meeting these requirements in other places?
Yeah, totally. And there are some great lessons to learn here. And really, the big pitfall to avoid, in my view, is to recognize that there's no easy button. And, you know, for anyone getting started at this, make sure to go and understand that there are two ways that vendors use to know who you don't know and how these methods are really fundamentally different. And that's really important as you go into it. You know, the first method is AI correlation of publicly available trade data things like shipping records, right? And this, I like to think of this one as the easy button, the AI correlation of public data. It's great for providing like the likelihood of your exposure. And here, think t-shirt sizing for the scale of exposure for your company as a whole, or perhaps you're looking to see, you know, is one business more risk or have more potential liability for forced labor than other parts of your business? And so it's really effective at that. But the problem with likely is that it's not good enough when it comes to compliance. When goods get stopped at the border, or the European authorities launch an investigation, what really matters is who's actually in your supply chain, in the value chain there for the products in question. Not who might be, but who really is. And false negatives can lead to exposure and fines and liability. But almost worse are false positives, where you proactively report something or you get penalized for something that isn't even a problem. And for anything that's stopped at the border, you've got to remember it's not just, you know, about goods in general, things that overall, it's about the specific goods and the bill of materials associated for them, for the goods that are held at customs. So, you know, simply put, likely is not good enough for compliance. And it really goes and exposes your business to large fines, service disruptions, you know, line shutdowns and reputational damage. The second way to go and do this, the second method is to systematically discover the sub-tiers that you actually use and have positive confirmation for those. And connect this back to the actual products that you make and the ones that are being shipped. And this is done, as I was mentioning, through the structured exchange of information to go and discover those sub-tiers tier by tier and what each sub-tier makes for you, where it's made, what and which products it goes into. And this creates compliance-grade due diligence with no noise, no false negatives, no false positives. And while this is, it's a much harder way to do it, this is not the easy button. The structured exchange of data approach is made much easier when you select a supply chain network vendor that specializes in connecting and orchestrating sub-tier processes between value chain partners. And, you know, that's what E2Open does, and it's a distinctive competency of ours. So I guess long story short, for what are the stumbling blocks and things that people can learn, it's that there are no shortcuts. So, you know, beware of anyone selling an easy button. The easy button, it does have valid use cases, but compliance isn't one of them. And with fines up to 5% of global revenues, this isn't the time to be penny wise and pound foolish.
No, indeed. Nope. Sounds like some real challenges coming up for many companies involved here. John, we really appreciate your coming on the show and walking us through this.
All right. Super. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Our guest this week has been John Lash from E2Open. Back to you, Dave.
Thank you, John and Ben. Now let's take a look at some of the other supply chain news from the week. And Victoria, you have a story coming out in the May issue of DC Velocity about sortation systems and the latest technologies behind them. Can you share the details?
Absolutely, Dave. Yeah, happy to. So we write about so many different types of material handling equipment and systems here at DC Velocity. And a common theme is often the tech side of those systems. Everything seems to be getting more and more high tech these days. And as you say, in our current issue, we take a look at how this trend is affecting sorters, which of course are often keys to keeping warehouses and distribution centers running smoothly and efficiently. Fortunately for me, our staff attended the 2024 MODEX Material Handling Show in Atlanta just as I was researching this story, so I was able to see some of the sort of latest and greatest sorting technologies in person. I highlighted a few of those to give our readers an idea of what's on the market.
So, Victoria, what did you focus on? What trends are you seeing in sortation equipment these days?
Well, the trend is definitely toward high-tech advances. Equipment makers are applying advanced controls, artificial intelligence, and robotics to make sorters faster, more accurate, and overall smarter. There were so many examples at MODEX, it's impossible to write about them all in one story, so I focused on three that stood out to me. The first was the introduction of advanced sorter controls from conveyance and parcel automation company Intralox. The company has introduced prepackaged advanced sorter controls for one of its sorters, and it's a feature that gives customers an out-of-the-box solution for improving the sorting process. Now, the advanced controls themselves allow customers to sort more precisely to a destination, you know, a conveyor, a bin, or Gaylord, for example. And they do that by accurately controlling where products exit the sorter. The out-of-the-box aspect just means that the controls are sort of simpler to install and get up and running. Essentially, what used to require customized work and a lot of time can now be accomplished with the touch of just a few screens. The two other solutions I highlight in the story include an AI or artificial intelligence driven sliding shoe sorter from True Automation and a robotic automated sortation and order retrieval system from OPEX Corporation. Listeners can get the details on all three of these by checking out the story, which again appears in our May issue. It's on our website already, and the print issue should be hitting readers' desks any day now.
Great. We look forward to reading more. Thank you, Victoria.
You're welcome.
And Ben, we've reported for months on the recession that has hit the freight industry, but you wrote this week that there may be a smoother road ahead. Can you tell us more?
I'd be glad to. That this is what in the lingo, so some people are calling green shoots, sort of just those first little spring sprouts there of hope. You know, both shippers and carriers throughout North America know all too well that the truckload industry has been in the low trough of a freight recession for about 18 months now, maybe 2 years. There are basically too many trucks and not enough cargo moving to fill them all, so rates have fallen, and a lot of carriers are barely breaking even. Things are better in the less than truckload area, but overall it's been tough to be a trucker lately. However, we've lately gotten some indication that things are finally getting ready to turn around. A couple weeks ago, we heard from ACT Research that an upturn is likely, they said, within a couple of months. They said the nation's Class 8 tractor fleet is nearly finished growing for a while, after expanding by actually 12% since the start of the pandemic. And at the same time, they pointed to trends like growing goods spending, turning inventory cycle, and rising industrial production. And those three things means that there'll be more stuff to move. And then this week, we heard a kind of a similar message from a different group. That's the truckload drivers themselves. The news came from a survey that was done by Bloomberg and Truckstop of owner-operators and small fleets. They said that the industry is emerging from a challenging quarter, sort of the obvious award there, and that the truckload sector remains flush with capacity. So again, that means too many trucks, not enough cargo. And yet, driver sentiment is going up.
Ben, what did the survey find that truck drivers are thinking right now?
Yeah, I mean, the drivers certainly agree that it's tough out there right now. So more than 6 in 10 drivers in the survey, they reported lower freight volumes in the first quarter than in fourth quarter last year. Conditions are so challenging that 44% of those respondents were unsure about their work status in the next 6 months. And 9%, almost 1 in 10, said they wanted to leave the trucking industry entirely. That's hard to hear, but, you know, in a tough love philosophy, that's maybe what the industry needs for some of the drivers to drop out so we no longer have that surplus of trucks. So although it's tough, the survey also found, like I said, there's some optimism out there in sentiment. So about a third predicted that freight demand will increase in the next 3 to 6 months. And that's compared to only 1 in 5 who think that it'll decline. Likewise, looking at freight rates, like I said, they've been dropping for the supply and demand reasons. But about a quarter of the people in the survey, the truckers expected those rates to decline over the next 3 to 6 months. So that's a smaller portion than those who said the same thing in the fourth quarter of last year. Likewise, another quarter of them said the rates will rise in the next 3 to 6 months. And that's more than said it in the previous quarter. So apologies for all the numbers there, but the bottom line is that that trend is running in the right direction. So basically, if you listen to the drivers, it looks like we're getting toward the end of this down cycle. And maybe after a transition period toward having fewer trucks, those drivers think that we're headed toward better market conditions for carriers within that 3 to 6 month range.
Well, we certainly hope so. Thank you, Ben.
Glad to.
We encourage listeners to go to dcvelocity.com for more on these and other supply chain stories. Also, check out the podcast notes section for some direct links to read more about the topics that we discussed today. And we'd like to thank John Lash of E2 Open for being our guest. We welcome your comments on this topic and our other stories. You can email us at podcast@agilebme.com. We also encourage you to subscribe to Logistics Matters at your favorite podcast platform. Our new episodes are uploaded on Fridays. And a reminder that Logistics Matters is sponsored by Yale Lift Truck Technologies. From purposefully designed warehouse lift trucks to next generation operator assist and automation technologies, Yale provides the solutions you need today and tomorrow. Learn how to unlock the full potential of your warehouse at yale.com. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Logistics Matters. Be sure to join us. Until then, have a great week.